Thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight. It's really good to be back here in Anchorage, which is where I was living before I started this reportage from the Middle East and all things related 6 years ago. I'm here to talk tonight about what's happening in the U.S. military as a result of both ongoing occupations. And primarily, there is a large amount of dissent in the U.S. military right now, and it is spreading despite lack of a cohesive, organized GI resistance movement like we saw during the Vietnam era. But before I can talk about dissent, we have to have a clear picture of directly what this U.S. foreign policy, specifically both these U.S. occupations abroad in Iraq and Afghanistan, what is the direct and immediate impact on the U.S. military and people inside the U.S. military? And I want to start by sharing a story, reading a bit from the book by a soldier, of a story of a soldier named Eli Wright. This is a guy who went over to Iraq, served as an army medic there. And I like to share this story because it gives people an idea of the first main reason why we're seeing breakdown in the military, and that is, what do people see and do when they go abroad? This is another reason why morale is as low as it is in the military today. So Eli Wright went over to Iraq as an army medic. He was with the 10th Mountain Division based out of Fort Drum in upstate New York. And he showed up and was ordered to go to an enemy detainment camp with another army medic. And they were theoretically going to be brought there to help provide services to an Iraqi detainee inside that camp, or so he thought. At the entrance of the detainment facility, Eli Wright was pulled aside by his battalion surgeon and instructed, quote, "Anything that you see in there, inside those walls, stays in there. You don't talk about any of it after you leave that place." The cell he was taken to was a dark, damp enclosure of bare concrete cinder block walls with a concrete floor and no lights. His memory reconstructs the scene. "It was the scent of blood that hit me immediately on walking in there. It was a sort of old, stale scent of blood that had just permeated that place for a long time. And they walked us inside, and there was this prisoner in there, completely naked, except for a small little cloth tied around his waist, and he was standing up on top of a cinder block that was placed on end. They said that he had been there for 3 days. His scabbed hands, tied with zip ties that cut into his wrists, were purple and swollen. This guy had the most confused, glazed look on his face. He was being interrogated by several men who were just grilling him. They said he had been up for 3 days in this interrogation process. He had not slept. He had been standing on this cinder block for most of the time. They had this bucket of water, which they would splash on him whenever he dozed off. They took him off the cinder block, stood him against the wall, and told us to start checking him out. I didn't even know where to begin. He was covered in bruises. His face was all busted up and bleeding. This other medic started to check him out. Our task was more or less to see if the guy was stable, to ascertain if he was in any condition to continue his interrogation. He had some cuts on his face, nose, eyebrows, and we started to tape those up, not really doing much, just kind of dabbing away blood clots and applying tape, not even cleaning his wounds or anything. He was complaining of pain on the side of his chest and his back. He had a lot of bruising on his ribs, so the medic started to feel his ribs, pressed on a couple of them, and the guy just screamed in pain and sort of buckled. They picked him up and slammed him back against the wall. The other medic asked me to verify his broken ribs, and I did. He then commenced to feel around the rest of the area around his ribs to feel if there were any more fractures, and then suddenly, he cocked his fist back and punched him right in the broken ribs. The guy just dropped and screamed. I was stunned. It shocked the hell out of me. It was an important moment for me, seeing a medic, a fellow care provider, violate our code of ethics, which is first and foremost to do no harm, and to see one of my own doing that to a, I guess he was just a prisoner to them, but to me, I didn't see him that way. He was a confused, broken human being. And to see a medic do that to him, I don't know, it just kind of destroyed my perception of us doing anything good there for these people. That's when I realized that we weren't there to help anybody. Nothing that we could do would be good. After that point, I didn't feel like there was any further good I could do for those people. That was my first night there. Eli Wright went on to serve a bit over a year in Iraq. It was more stories not dissimilar from that, coupled with the usual stories that I've heard from so many veterans that I've interviewed for this book and forthcoming stories about random killings, random bombings, seeing their friends die, killing Iraqis, detaining innocent people, et cetera, et cetera. These are the types of stories that are happening every day in Iraq and Afghanistan right now, and these are the stories that these veterans are coming back home with and then get to deal with on their own when they run up against the next main segment of context that we have to talk about before we talk about dissent is what happens to veterans when they do come back home. What happens to them when they're kept in the military and they're repeatedly redeployed? And then what happens to them once they actually get a valid discharge and then try to get benefits from a Veterans Administration that, as we speak, is overtaxed and overburdened trying to treat people? Surpassed only by the average Iraqi or person in Afghanistan, people in the U.S. military today are now part of a very quickly growing, unfortunate, tragic segment of U.S. society that has been maligned and tossed aside, neglected, forgotten. Today, more U.S. war veterans are killing themselves than are dying in open combat overseas. According to the Veterans Administration, if we include veterans of all wars, 18 veterans a day are committing suicide in this country. Also, according to the VA, 1,000 veterans who are technically under the auspices of VA care are attempting suicide every single month. Also, then when they come back home and they do get a valid discharge from the military, the average wait for a soldier for their first appointment at the Veterans Administration is 6 months. It's 179 days. So think about a soldier comes back home, they have severe post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, they might have traumatic brain injury, which is what happens when a roadside bomb goes off nearby your patrol and your brain gets slapped around in your skull a bit. And then they discharge from the military and they decide finally, generally after doing some pretty serious self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, they realize, look, I'm not sleeping, I'm having nightmares, flashbacks, I feel violent rage much of the time, all very, very common symptoms of PTSD. And they finally break down and decide, okay, I think I will go to the VA and get some help. Well, their average wait is 179 days. If they file a disability claim with the VA and that claim is denied, and then they appeal that claim, the average wait is 4.5 years. So how do these folks get through that time? And that's why when we talk about suicides, the statistics that I'm going to share with you are very, very shocking, but they're a little bit less shocking when you hear them in the context of what I just spoke of. 2006 was a record year of suicides in the Army. More people killed themselves in the Army that year since the Pentagon started keeping that statistic in 1980. It was surpassed in 2007, another record suicide year in the Army, which was surpassed in 2008, another record suicide year in the Army. 2008 was also a record suicide year in the Marine Corps. In 2009, we're right on target to have another record suicide year in the Army. In fact, another thing that compounds this problem before people discharge is how often people are being redeployed. More than 565,000 troops have been deployed more than one time. By December of 2006, it was estimated that 50% of the troops were in Iraq were serving their second tour, and another 25% were on their third or their fourth tours. These numbers are far, far higher today. They've significantly increased, and actually I've been talking with people who've served 5, 6, even 7 tours abroad, which again, considering the length of these occupations, isn't such a big surprise. So what's the military trying to do to cope with having enough soldiers to populate both occupations? We still have between 120,000 and 124,000 soldiers in Iraq, and we will have by the end of this year roughly 69,000 American troops, while the Obama administration ponders how many of tens of thousands more to send. So what they're doing is redeploying is, of course, the first option where, for example, in Vietnam, if you were drafted, you only had to go do one tour. Then, of course, you were given the option to go back, which, of course, most people declined. Well, today in the military, since it's theoretically an all-volunteer force, I say theoretically because of the poverty draft that's been happening now and is happening now more than ever, because people stay in the military, they go do a tour, they come back, and they get locked in. We have stop loss, for example. Even people who come up near the end of their contract, there was stop loss was instituted September 11, 01 by George Bush, George W. Bush. And what that means is if I join and I sign, say, an average four-year contract, and I serve a tour, two tours, whatever, and then I come back home and I've got 2 or 3 weeks left in my contract, the military has the right to say, sorry, national emergency, your country needs you, you're going to Afghanistan. So right now, the most recent Pentagon figures I've seen are that 6% of the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are stop lost. We've had more than 200,000 soldiers stop lost since September 11, 2001. This is not exactly helping morale, and you can understand why. In addition, we've had, as of last year, more than 43,000 troops already diagnosed with either severe PTSD or traumatic brain injuries or other debilitating medical conditions that had already listed them as technically unfit for deployment. More than 43,000 of those troops have been deployed anyway. So then how does this translate into, what does this look like on the ground over in Iraq and Afghanistan? By October 2007, the Army reported that approximately 12% of combat troops in Iraq and 17% of combat troops in Afghanistan were coping by taking antidepressants and or sleeping pills. Another important factor when we talk about morale, roughly one-third of the soldiers in both occupations right now are members of the National Guard. So much for one weekend a month. This isn't exactly helping morale either. Also, attempting to keep enough boots on the ground for both occupations, on June 2206, the Army increased the permissible enlistment age up to 42 from a previous limit of 40. This follows a previous rise in the age limit from 35 to 40 in March 05. By summer 07, the Army had grown so desperate for recruits that it began to recruit indiscriminately in violation of its own criteria. It accepted individuals with health and weight issues, lower academic test scores, and even those with criminal records. By July 07, the number of incoming soldiers with prior felony arrests or convictions had more than tripled over the previous 5 years. And in the first half of 2007, the Army had accepted an estimated 8,000 recruits with rap sheets. So we do technically have convicted rapists and convicted felons serving in the U.S. military today. One example, former Army Private Steve Green was awarded a waiver for previous involvement in criminal activity in lieu of joining the military, and was later found guilty for raping a 14-year-old Iraqi girl and then murdering her and three of her family members and trying to burn the bodies to hide the evidence. So again, people like this serving in the military, how does that play out with folks that join for other reasons, for example, not joining to get out of going to jail or joining for patriotic reasons or to serve their country or to carry on a family legacy, people that really enjoy serving in the military, they intend to be in it for life, and then they see the lower ranks swelling with people who have rap sheets or gang members who are intentionally joining to get combat experience and learn how to do surveillance and be a good sniper and to be able to bring that back and use it on the streets and in cities in the U.S. So this is all happening in the military as well, in addition to people not getting the care that they need both while they're in the military as well as once they discharge. I would confidently argue that the military is in an ongoing state of crisis today. And one thing I'll speak to underscore this fact, last May, many people in this room probably heard, in Baghdad, a U.S. soldier on the end of his third deployment walked into a PTSD clinic and gunned down five other soldiers. Right in the wake of that, we had Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, the highest person in the military, below, of course, the Commander-in-Chief. He went into the media along with Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, both of them saying this is a crisis, this is a result of too many redeployments, this is a result of not enough time at home in between deployments, this is a result of soldiers not getting the psychological care and treatment that they need, both while they're serving and after they discharge. They said all these things which were fantastic and spot on. I couldn't agree with them more. The problem was they said this and they talked about changing policy, but aside from a few minor tweaks, they have basically not changed policy. And so we have situations like Fort Hood, where we have Major Nidal Hassan, who, while he did not serve in Iraq or Afghanistan, had been spent a lot of time in Walter Reed Hospital counseling, giving psychiatric counseling to soldiers coming back from both occupations with severe PTSD. And there are actually been a lot of people in the military already calling for, look, we need, obviously, PTSD treatment for soldiers themselves, but then we need PTSD treatment for the counselors. Because this happens to journalists, too, when you hear one traumatic story after another, day after day after day, you're going to need to talk to somebody about that. So Major Hassan, of course, his family in the aftermath of Fort Hood talked about this, that this guy had a very heavy workload that was consistently being increased. He was hearing these horrible, horrible stories, and that coupled with him being opposed to both occupations, coupled with his religion, coupled with ongoing harassment for being a Muslim in the U.S. military, all of this over time, clearly the guy snapped. But there were people in the military at Fort Hood, even veterans there who had been warning against this problem, this type of a serious situation happening a long time in advance. In fact, there's a guy named Chuck Luther there at Fort Hood who's a two-tour Iraq veteran who came out. He came out in the wake of the Fort Hood tragedy, talking about how he had been warning the chain of command of this type of thing happening for a long time. He was telling folks, look, people are being exposed to secondary trauma. We need help for these counselors, or we're going to have something else happen right here in the mainland, just like what happened over in Baghdad last May. And this is a guy, he has been discharged from the military, Chuck Luther, but then he has chosen to stay on Fort Hood and has formed a soldiers advocacy group to try to help soldiers get some of the things that I've been talking about tonight. But he actually said, I talked to him just a few days ago also about his efforts to try to change things on the ground there at Fort Hood, and he said, quote, there will be more 5 November attacks on fellow soldiers, 5 November being, of course, the Fort Hood tragedy, and they will likely be even more drastic, he explains. Everybody has to outdo someone, so the next are likely to be worse. Violence breeds violence. I was trained to be very violent in combat as a scout. We killed or detained Iraqis before anyone else got there. 2 months ago, I warned the Army's chain of command that before we had an attack by a soldier on other troops, when they come home, we needed to make some dramatic changes. So all of this works in concert to have formed a lot of dissent in the military. And when I talk about dissent, I talk about this coming from low morale from what soldiers see directly when they go overseas, coupled with not getting the care that they need that I talked about. So both of those working in concert, it's causing people to stand up and publicly refuse to go over to both occupations. And it's causing a lot of other different types of dissent in the military and resistance as well. And I'll talk about a lot of this. First and most overtly, I ran into about 2 years ago, I was on tour for my first book, and I was giving talks about what I was seeing in Iraq, and I started to meet veterans. There were a lot of veterans coming to my talks. And so as usual, when I meet these folks, we would sit down and talk about where were you, when were you there, what was it like, what did you see. And what I was hearing, first of all, I met a guy named Phil Aliff, a corporal in the U.S. Army in the 10th Mountain Division, and he served over in Iraq. And he said, well, morale was very low for us, and we basically decided that we didn't want to keep driving around on these patrols waiting to get blown up. We didn't feel like we were helping anybody. We certainly weren't helping ourselves, and we certainly weren't helping the Iraqi people. And he said, from the best that we could judge, we were basically just driving around waiting to get blown up. And I've heard that also referred to by other soldiers as the IED lottery, the improvised explosive device lottery, where you just basically drive out and wonder, well, is this going to be the day? And so he said, so what we decided to do was as a platoon, we would drive our Humvees out to the end of the patrol route. We'd find a nice, big, wide-open field, park our Humvees, call into base every hour and say, hey, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. We'll talk to you in an hour. And he said we would sit there and smoke cigarettes and drink soda and listen to music and pretend. And I was shocked. I hadn't heard anything like this before. And I was taking some notes, and I said, well, how often was this happening? And he said, every other day. He said, oh, everyone was doing it. And so I took notes and just kind of held on to it. And then a couple of days later, I met another veteran, and I asked him, hey, have you ever heard of these search and avoid missions, which is what they were being referred to, which, of course, is what they were called during the Vietnam War. Search and avoid, of course, rather than search and destroy. And so I asked this another fellow, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, everybody was doing that. And he was over in Iraq, different time of the occupation, different area of Iraq. And so I kept meeting more and more veterans. And at this point, I realized, okay, there's something going on here. I'm gonna look into this. And I kept meeting more and more people. And the more people I talked with, I heard more and more variations on the theme. I met a guy named Seth Manzel, who was with the Striker Brigade. And he was up in northern Iraq about a year after the first couple of folks I talked with about their search and avoid missions. And he said, oh, we found actually a different way to do search and avoid missions. We actually figured out how to get into the computers in our Humvees, because all of them are teched out with GPS and location devices and all of this, so they can track them back at base. And we actually found a way to get into the computer and move our little blip around to do kind of virtual patrols. So we would leave a guy in the Humvee doing that, and we would go have soccer games with Iraqi kids or drink tea in some Iraqi's house. Iraqis love to invite you into their houses and serve you gallons of tea. So we would go do that. And I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. And at first I didn't believe it. How do you get into a Humvee and get into the computer, that is, and move the blip around? And then a little bit later I met a guy named Josh Simpson. Different part of Iraq, different time of the occupation. He said, oh, yeah, well, we figured out this great thing to do. We could actually hack into the computer and move our little blip around and do virtual patrols. So, again, very, very common. And then several other folks that I interviewed for the book shared similar stories as well. So there was a lot of that. There's a lot of comparisons to Vietnam, and largely they're way, way off. Because people ask, well, how much resistance is there of this type, direct resistance happening in Iraq and Afghanistan? And certainly compared to Vietnam, it's minuscule. In Vietnam, for those who haven't read history or weren't around at that time, this country has a very rich tradition of GI resistance. In Vietnam, there is a GI resistance movement that was so powerful that by the end of the Vietnam War, nearly half the soldiers on the ground would not follow orders. They would not comply. They would not do missions. And there was little the military could do about it, and there was certainly little that the government could do about it. Basically, when you have a military that is in that far advanced of a state of collapse where nearly half the people on the ground won't follow orders, it's kind of hard to fight a war. So that was a very huge factor, coupled with a powerful anti-war movement here in the U.S., coupled with the very fierce Vietnamese resistance, those three factors brought an end to Vietnam. And so, okay, we're gonna have a Q&A after this. So, okay, well. You know, we'll have a Q&A, and I'll call on you straight away. I've spent 9 months in Iraq.
In the military.
Right. No, not in the military. Okay. All right. Carrying on. So where was I? So when we finishing talking about Vietnam, as I said, we had a very fierce GI resistance movement that brought that to an end. And as I was saying, we don't have anything like that happening right now in Iraq. Also, what happened during Vietnam, just to kind of flush this out, to also underscore that we really don't have anything like that happening today. Before the end of Vietnam, actually around the time of Operation Rolling Thunder, when there was a massive escalation in the air campaign, two of the U.S.'s 14 aircraft carrier groups were taken completely offline by sailors inside those ships. So my point is, we had a very, very fierce, organized, powerful GI resistance movement in Vietnam, and we don't have anything like that today. However, we do have a lot of ongoing types of dissent and breaking ranks within the military in Iraq happening right now and in Afghanistan as we speak, as I'm in direct contact with soldiers in both places right now. And there's other types of resistance in the military that's happening related to different types of problems. And I'll come back to direct resistance to Iraq and Afghanistan. But there's other big problems in the military that I want to talk to you about, that soldiers are taking it upon themselves to stand up and fight against. And these are not problems, a lot of these problems are not directly related to Iraq and Afghanistan, but they're more systemic problems in the U.S. military. So I have a chapter in the book called Resisting Sexism, and it's about rape and sexual assault in the U.S. military. And according to VA statistics, 1 in 3 women in the military is raped or sexually assaulted before the end of their contract. And so I've heard giving talks a counter-argument, well, that's comparable to the civilian rate in the general population of the United States. It's about 1 in 3, as though that should make it okay. My counter argument to that is, okay, well, 1 in 3 women in the civilian population is raped in their lifetime. 1 in 3 women in the military is raped in an average 4-year contract. So 4 years compared to a lifetime. So that shows it's a pretty severe situation. There's also a Pentagon report that came out that showed 80% of all rapes and sexual assaults in the military never go reported. 80%. Very, very high. And so when someone's raped in the military, I want to read a brief paragraph from a woman named April Fitzsimmons, who served in the Air Force from 85 to 89 as an intelligence analyst, an intelligence briefer for a 2-star general. Early on in her military career, she was sexually assaulted by another soldier, and she spoke very clearly about what it's like in this military culture when someone who's been raped or sexually assaulted basically goes and gets help for it and admits that this has happened to them and does officially report it, and then people start to hear about it. Fitzsimmons says, quote, "When victims come forward, they are ostracized, doubted, and isolated from their communities. They are punished. Many of the perpetrators are officers who use their ranks to coerce women to sleep with them. On being asked, all they have to do is deny it, after which they are reprimanded and sent away. It's a closely interwoven community, so the perpetrators are safe within the system and can fearlessly move free amongst their victims. The crisis is so severe that I'm telling women to simply not join the military because it's completely unsafe and puts them at risk. Until something changes at the top, no woman should join the military." Another person I want to talk about related to this topic is former General Janice Karpinski. You may have heard of her. She was one of the generals in charge of Abu Ghraib when the scandal broke in spring 2004. And she was, to date anyway, has been the highest ranking person in the military to be a fall person for that scandal, even though there's it's long since come out, there's direct proof, documented evidence that Don Rumsfeld, at the very lowest, if not higher than him, but at least Don Rumsfeld had given direct orders to have people tortured at Abu Ghraib and other military detention facilities. But I met her back in January 2006. We were both at a conference together. And at that conference, Karpinski testified that a coalition joint task force surgeon said in a briefing that women soldiers had died of dehydration in the 130-degree heat of Baghdad. They refused to drink liquids in the latter part of the day because they were reluctant to use latrines, which were located outside the barracks after dark, for fear of being sexually assaulted or raped by male soldiers. Generators at the camp were loud enough to muffle the sound of the women's screams as male soldiers jumped them and dragged them and sexually assaulted them. Speaking of Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who was commander of coalition forces in Iraq from June 03 to June 04, Karpinski said, "Rather than make everybody aware of that, because that's shocking, and as a leader, if that's not shocking to you, then you're not much of a leader, what they told the surgeon is, don't brief those details anymore. And don't say specifically that they're women. You can provide that in a written report, but don't brief it out in the open anymore." She spoke just before this conference at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law about sexual assaults in Iraq and their cover-up, and said then, quote, "It was out of control. An 800 number existed as a helpline for women to use to report sexual assaults, but no one had a phone, and no one answered the number, which was based in the United States." She informed the audience that after more than 80 incidents were reported during a six-month period in Iraq and Kuwait, the rape hotline was still being answered by a machine that told callers to leave a message. "There were innumerable such situations all over the theater of operations," she said, "because female soldiers didn't have a voice individually or collectively. Even as a general, I didn't have a voice with Sanchez, so I know what the soldiers were facing. Sanchez did not want to hear about female soldier requirements and or issues." Later, she quoted Sanchez to me as saying, quote, "The women asked to be here, so now let them take what comes with the territory." There is, thankfully, pushback against this by women in the U.S. military. There's a lot of women that have formed a group called SWAN, Service Women's Action Network, and it's a group trying to get policy changes, get things changed in the structure of the military so that hopefully somehow this massive incidence of rampant rape and sexual assault might decline. And one woman I spoke with who I also wrote about in the book, her name's Marisela Guzman. She's from the greater LA area, and she decided what she would do was, since she was recruited right at the end of her high school career to go into the military, and that's why she joined, she decided, and then of course she too was sexually assaulted, so she took it upon herself to basically talk to as many high school age girls as possible about the reality of the situation, that if you are a woman in this country and you're going to join the military, you have a 1 in 3 chance at a minimum of being raped or sexually assaulted before the end of your contract. So she decided she would go around and talk to high school kids in the greater LA area. And I asked her, well, how many folks do you figure you've talked to based on class size, based on how often you've done it? And she said, I've talked to, I think, about over 30,000 kids so far. So there is this type of pushback happening, and it's continuing. There's hearings on the Hill. The military, of course, comes out in these hearings and says, yes, we're making these policy changes, these dramatic shifts, et cetera, more training, et cetera. But I called the Pentagon not too long ago and talked with them because I'm doing some follow-up stories on this situation, which are more shocking than some of these stories in the book. But the Pentagon, I asked them, well, what have you instituted to try to correct this problem? And I basically was fed a lot of lines about, well, we have this kind of training now, and we have Sexual Assault Awareness Week, and these T-shirts, and then at the end of the conversation, the public affairs officer I spoke with said, "But basically, what we're doing is we're asking people to watch each other's backs." So it's going to take a bit more than that, clearly. So there is pushback on that, however. Another situation I want to talk about in the military addresses homophobia in the military. Of course, given the U.S. military is arguably the most misogynistic institution on the planet, there's a lot of racism and homophobia. And sorry, everybody, we'll have a Q&A session after the talk. Rampant homophobia. So what happens is, of course, most people are probably familiar with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where this is this brilliant policy instituted under President Bill Clinton that basically says if you're gay, you can join the military and you can be in the military, and no one's allowed to ask you about whether you're gay or not. And as long as you don't tell anyone, then we can't kick you out. So of course, the understanding is if you tell someone, then the military has to kick you out. So I have a chapter really detailing what it's like to be a gay person in that kind of a military today. And I spent a lot of time specifically on a guy named Jeff Key, a Lance Corporal from the Marine Corps Reserve who was in Iraq during the invasion, during which time, based on what he saw and what he was asked to do, he turned vehemently against the occupation. And then he served his tour and he came back home, and he was based at Camp Pendleton, the largest Marine base in the United States. It's over just north of San Diego. And he was there on March 31, 2004. This is the day that the four Blackwater mercenaries were killed in Fallujah and the terrible things done to their bodies. You've all probably seen, when it happened, the photos and video of that about 8,000 times on CNN. And Jeff Key, he's a big, strapping Marine. He's like 6'6", blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, kind of like a poster boy for the Marine Corps. So he was asked, being that he was based there at Camp Pendleton at the time and had been back from Iraq not that long, he was asked on to the Paul Is On Now show on CNN to discuss soldier morale in the wake of the killings of these four Blackwater mercenaries in Fallujah that day. So he agreed to go on to the show, and Paul Is On asked Jeff Key, quote, "I know I winced when I saw these pictures for the first time. When you saw these images of American soldiers not only being," she calls them soldiers, "not only being brutally beaten and murdered, but dragged down the street, what went through your mind?" A little bit of a leading question. Key responded, "Oh, I first saw it this morning when I was sitting at the computer, and honestly, my first thoughts were that I had a lot of intense anger. I wanted to go back and find the people who did that and hunt them down. It's the Marine in me. I wanted to exact revenge." Then, using the platform he had been offered, roughly 7 million viewers, Keyes went on to add, "Shortly thereafter, I started to think about the families. There are several families today that are changed forever because of the events in Iraq today. I've spent a lot of time in introspection and thinking since I came back from Iraq about our mission there and what it meant to me. I have very conflicting feelings about it. I'm still intensely committed to the reasons I became a Marine 4 years ago and have decided this week to leave the Marine Corps, actually, and came out of the closet as a gay man. I had made sweeping rationalizations that allowed me to continue to lie about my sexuality and stay in the Marine Corps in attempts to stay true to my commitments to the reasons I joined. And having come back and having received a lot of information, things we didn't know when we were there, that we were never told about weapons of mass destruction, about our entering there in the first place, I just bang." And at that point, Paul Is On cuts him off and basically tries to figure out, what is the fastest way I can get this big, handsome, gay Marine off the TV as quickly as possible? And she did. She did a good job. She got him off pretty quick. So Key basically expected to go back to his barracks and have an order, pack your bags, you're out of here. And it didn't come. And it didn't come the next week. It didn't come the next week. And I believe it was about 6 weeks later, Key ended up getting the word to go. It was a very dark time for him because he really enjoyed being in the military. He had many very close friends. He loved serving his country in that way. But He went on to say, quote, "I left Fort Pendleton that day, and as I was driving, realizing I would never drive on that base again as a Marine was horrible. I was so angry at the people who had stolen that from me and just disgusted, and disgusted at the bloodbath that was going on in Iraq and continues to go on." He wanted to just leave it all behind and go back into civilian life and put it all behind him and carry forward, but he realized instead he needed to continue speaking out about don't ask, don't tell, and specifically about what gay people should do, whether they're thinking of joining the military or what they should do if they're already in it. And his advice today to anyone, gay or straight, about whether or not to enter the military is this: I would say don't. Do not join the U.S. military. In the foreseeable future, no matter which wing of the one party we have in this country happens to sit in the White House, their soldiers' commitment is going to be abused. His advice to a young gay person who may be considering joining the military is to, quote, work through your homophobia in another way. If you think that your homophobia doesn't have any bearing on your wanting to join the military, then I would ask them to examine all the other good reasons somebody might want to join. If you need money for college, I promise you there are other ways. Money is not a justification for what you'll be asked to do. I would say to those kids, don't join. For those already in the military, Key says this: I would tell them to take a good, long, hard look at how the military is being used now. If that resonates with their spirit in a good way, then God bless them and keep going. If I could ever help you, let me know, I will. But if it does not resonate with what you believe to be noble, then step up to the front and say, I'm a big fat homosexual, and leave the military today. That would be an interesting GI resistance movement. It's a thought. Finally, I want to talk briefly about instances of people who have chosen to stand up and directly disobey orders to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. And in the context for this, I want to talk briefly, I try to do it in a way that's as least boring as possible, about law. And it's a given at this point that Iraq, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, of course, was a given before the fact, but basically anybody with some gray matter upstairs understands that this was an illegal violation that violated international law. And it violated international law because, according to the UN Charter, of which the U.S. is a signatory country, in order to have a just war, you have to have UN Security Council ratification, or it's an act of self-defense. Of course, Iraq was neither. But today, there are international lawyers and people like Marjorie Cohn, the president of the National Lawyers Guild here in the United States, that are arguing that Afghanistan does not meet the criteria of a just war either. Of course, that situation for that situation, the U.S. did not have UN Security Council ratification, but she's arguing it's not actually an act of self-defense either, that being the war. She says that basically when the U.S. was attacked, it wasn't actually attacked by either the nation nor the people of Afghanistan. It was 19 guys in planes, 15 of them from Saudi Arabia, the other four, none from Iraq or Afghanistan. So there is a large body of lawyers now, international lawyers, arguing that Afghanistan, therefore, is also a violation of international law. And then there's a thing in the U.S. Constitution, it's called the Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Paragraph 2. And the Supremacy Clause says, and this is also what these lawyers are arguing, is that in the Supremacy Clause, actually they don't need to argue this part, the Supremacy Clause says when the U.S. signs a foreign treaty, then we are obliged by our own Constitution to follow that treaty as though it's the law of our land as well. Hence the word Supremacy Clause. So therefore, if a soldier refuses to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan, they're adhering to international law, the U.S. Constitution, and then when you get down to the oath that soldiers swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States by following lawful orders, those who refuse orders to deploy are actually adhering to their oath to a T, adhering to the U.S. Constitution, and adhering to international law. So, in that context, we talk about some of these recent resistors, recent being resistors of these current two wars. And the first conscientious objector to the Iraq War was a guy named Camilo Mejia. And he stood up in 2004. This is a guy who served a tour in Ramadi. He saw a lot of combat. He had a lot of buddies killed. He himself killed a lot of people. And he came back from his deployment and realized the catastrophe that he was part of and decided he cannot continue to be part of it. He stood up. He publicly refused to redeploy. He actually was on a lot of national media who were accusing him of being a coward. Are you afraid? He was being asked. And at the time, he responded by writing this paragraph that I'd like to read. I say without any pride that I did my job as a soldier. I commanded an infantry squad in combat, and we never failed to accomplish our mission. But those who called me a coward, without knowing it, are also right. I was a coward not for leaving the war, but for having been a part of it in the first place. Refusing and resisting this war was my moral duty, a moral duty that called me to take a principled action. I failed to fulfill my moral duty as a human being, and instead I chose to fulfill my duty as a soldier. All because I was afraid. I was terrified. I did not want to stand up to the government and the army. I was afraid of punishment and humiliation. I went to war because at the moment I was a coward, and for that I apologize to my soldiers for not being the type of leader I should have been. A couple of years later, we had a guy named Lieutenant Aaron Watada in the summer of 2006 stand up and publicly refuse a combat deployment to Iraq. At the time, he was the highest ranking member of the military to publicly refuse a combat deployment. And he was, of course, court-martialed, as is always the case when folks do this. He was court-martialed, however, the judge blew the trial. So he was then relegated to sitting behind a desk shuffling papers around for a pretty long while until roughly 4 or 5 weeks ago from today, he was released by the military. So this is an interesting case because so far, therefore, we have the highest ranking member of the military to date to publicly refuse a combat deployment to Iraq, not have to serve one day in a military brig, nor one day overseas. Excuse me. More recently, at Fort Hood, there was a guy named Specialist Victor Augusto. Specialist Augusto had served a 15-month tour in Iraq, and it was there that he, too, turned against the occupation. Of his time there, he told me, quote, "It was in Iraq that I turned against the occupations. I started to feel very guilty. I watched contractors making obscene amounts of money. I found no evidence that the occupation was in any way helping the people of Iraq. I know I contributed to death and human suffering. It's hard to quantify how much I caused, but I know I contributed to it." So he also, another factor in this, he got back and that was his feeling, but he figured, hey, I've got about 6 weeks left in my contract, my 4-year contract. I'm about to get out. I'm just going to suck it up. And this is extremely common with people in the military right now, mostly for economic reasons. But what happened was just a few weeks before the end of his contract, the military said, sorry, you're stop loss. We need you to go prepare to get ready to go to Afghanistan. And so on May 1st, this past May, he was ordered to go to that soldier readiness facility where Major Hassan slaughtered the 13 soldiers and wounded all the others. It's basically a processing facility where soldiers go right before they're going to deploy abroad to do paperwork and last-minute medical stuff. So Specialist Augusto was ordered to go there, and he said no. And so his commander wrote him a counseling statement, which basically is something he has to sign as a soldier saying, yes, I disobeyed this direct order. So he signed it, but then he also wrote, there is no way I will deploy to Afghanistan. The occupation is immoral and unjust. It does not make the American people any safer. It has the opposite effect. 10 days later, he was given another direct order to go to the soldier readiness facility and begin his processing to go to Afghanistan. Again, he disobeyed the direct order. Again, he was issued a counseling statement. Again, he signed it. And on this one, he wrote, "I will not obey any orders I deem to be immoral or illegal." So he is shortly thereafter court-martialed. When folks like this stand up, they're going to receive anywhere from typically 1 month to a year in a military brig. Sometimes it could potentially be many years. So they know when they stand up that they are putting jail time on the line. They're going to lose most, if not all, of their pay. They're going to be reduced down to a private. And then when they get out, they're going to probably be given a dishonorable discharge. So no VA benefits for life, and certainly no college money in the GI Bill. So I talked to him right before his court-martial, and I said, "Look, you're about to get hammered. Are you sure about what you're doing here?" And he said, quote, "Yes, I'm fully prepared for this. I have concluded that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are not going to be ended by politicians or people at the top. The politicians or people at the top are not responsive to regular people. They're responsive to corporate America. The only way to make them responsive to the needs of the people is for soldiers to not fight their wars. If soldiers won't fight their wars, the wars won't happen. I hope I'm setting an example for other soldiers." Well, shortly thereafter, he got his hope. There was a guy named Sergeant Travis Bishop who also had served a 15-month tour in Iraq, where he realized he was opposed not just to Iraq, not just to Afghanistan, but all wars. What a lot of people don't understand, as was true during Vietnam, remains true today, is the military has this thing called conscientious objector status, that at any time, anyone in the military can apply for CO status. And this means you can't pick and choose, well, I'm for this war or against this war, or you know, I'll go to Iraq, but I won't go to Afghanistan, or vice versa. But if you file for CO status, you have to be opposed to all wars, and then you begin a process of talking to a military chaplain, having recommendations, writing an essay to try to prove that your spiritual beliefs and or religious beliefs make it so that you cannot participate in violence, i.e. you cannot participate in war of any kind. So Sergeant Travis Bishop came back from Iraq. He started the process of his application for conscientious objector status. He is ordered deployed to Afghanistan around that time, and of course then he refuses to go. He was in the midst of his CO application. He of course is court-martialed and found of course guilty of a couple of different counts, and is right now in the brig at Fort Lewis, Washington State, serving out a year prison sentence, and of course he is forfeited two-thirds of his pay when he's there, and when he gets out, he'll likely be getting a dishonorable discharge, and his rank was reduced from sergeant down to private. So, again, I was actually down at Fort Hood last summer and attended his court-martial and watched him get a sentence and then spoke with him right before he was put in manacles and walked to a van and taken to jail, and I asked Sergeant Bishop, I said, "Look, you know, you're about to go to jail. How do you feel about this? About what you're doing? You know, there's hardly anybody doing this. There really isn't an organized movement. There's not a whole lot of attention right now in the general population." And he said, "Look, you know, yeah, I don't want to go to jail. Who wants to go to jail? We've all heard the stories." But he said, I feel like this is the right thing to do, and this is what I need to do to be able to sleep with myself at night, so at least I'll be able to get some good sleep in jail. And interestingly, literally driving over here tonight, I got a call from Sergeant Bishop from the brig and letting me know how things were going. And again, I asked him, "Well, you know, how are things?" And he says, "Well, you know, as usual, the food sucks. And you know, it's a bit boring, but I'm reading a lot and I'm writing a lot. And I still feel very, very good about what I have done." And so the point is this, and the thought that I like to leave people with is, while we do not have a massive organized GI resistance movement, nothing even comes close to what we had during Vietnam, we do have many, many instances and growing numbers of instances of people expressing dissent in the military various ways. Pentagon figures to date show that on any given year from 2001 to right now, between 4,000 and 12,000 people are going absent without leave from the military. And these numbers right now are increasing in direct correlation to President Obama's first surge into Afghanistan and now being on the eve of a second surge. The only question is, when will it happen and how many troops is that going to be? So in this current climate, then the question I like to leave folks to think about is, you know, when we talk about support the troops, what is it that people can do to support the troops? And think about that, whether, you know, I think this is a topic that cuts across the entire political spectrum. Does support the troops mean you're going to put a little yellow magnetized ribbon magnet on the back of your SUV? Or does it mean you're going to find these people that are in your community and need help getting to their VA appointments and need help getting counseling and they're not getting it? Because these people are in all of our communities across this entire country and they need help and they feel isolated and people are afraid to talk with them. And so one way folks can support the troops is to find these people and simply talk to them and then ask them what could be done to help you. But there's that factor, and then there's other factors of, you know, people need to know that there's other options, that if they think that they can only join the military today to get a college education and that's the only way to get it, there are other alternatives to that too. But that said, if you're opposed to both of these occupations and you feel that they are not in the best interest of this country or international law or the countries where they're taking place, the thought I do want to leave you with is this. Think about what these soldiers, the Camilo Mejias, the Aaron Watadas, the Specialist Victor Augustos, the Sergeant Travis Bishops, what they were willing to do to follow their conscience. They're willing to put it all on the line and risk jail time and losing their money, the esteem of their peers, to stand up because it was simply the right thing to do. And if they're willing to do that, then what is each one of us willing to do to end both these occupations? Thank you.